This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Fernando Cortez. He is a political activist from Guadalajara, Mexico. Fernando, it's great having you on.
Thank you, Robert. Thank you for having me. It's great to be on your show.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Charles Lincoln.
Hi, Robert. Long time no talk. How you been?
Hi, great. First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got interested in a lot of these issues that we'll be covering throughout our show.
Well, regarding how I got into nationalist ideologies and the studies of the different currents that it has around the world, it pretty much started with me trying to understand, since I was very young, the root cause of the problems that I saw around me in Mexico. Because even though I had a normal middle-class life with a good education and everything that you could want to have a proper development, I would hear a lot of stories of relatives and ancestors of mine of how hard it was for them to get ahead and actually have a future and a social standing in Mexico. So when I started to go deeper into history beyond what I was told in school, which was basically that we were just some Indians that got conquered and ransacked by Spain. And I try to go into a little bit deeper into that, especially because on my mother's side, well, I had just Spanish ancestors, and they all seemed to be good people, not really go along with that narrative. And I saw that it was pretty hard for them as well, and that the government had taken everything from them as well. So that's when I started to understand that there was like a different position and different forces beyond the population, whether it was the mestizo one or the Indians or the Spaniards or the criollos. I saw that there were different forces trying to make of Mexico more of a little gold mine than an actual nation. And when I got into that, that's when I understood and started seeing that these forces were not just national, but they were international, and that nationalist movements around the world were being suppressed by an idea that we now see pretty collapsed, and we see its failure, which is the one world, one government idea. And it is through that I've been knowing nice people like you guys, which have a similar stance in your respective countries.
What are you involved with a particular organization, or are you just sort of an independent activist?
Well, we founded a few organizations in Mexico before. The Center for Moralist and Ethics Studies and Hyperborean Research, it was called. Then we tried to found a Anahuac Party of Social Integration, which in Spanish it's Partido Anahuac de Integración Social, which would be país or country. And then when we saw all the different problems that the government puts, like the obstacles for new parties and all the signatures and the requirements for each signature, we were very young and we understood that you couldn't do that without the help of the bank or of the big money. And we started to understand more of how politics actually works and how it's become more of a business and a struggle between businessmen than an actual reflection of what the populace wants. So I've been in a few organizations. We've founded a few, but there hasn't been something really formal in Mexico yet, and that's part of what we want to do and why we started. We made the International Identitarian Congress last May with Sundell and Weber and Pedro Varela and David Duke and all of them who visited my hometown Guadalajara, and there we tried to spark we tried to light up the spark of different movements that were kind of going stale in Mexico, and so far it has been working. Like the momentum that you see in the United States with white America, You can also see it with nationalists in all of Latin America, especially including Mexico.
Robert, I just wanted to interject here that, you know, I had the opportunity of meeting Fernando for the first time in Orange County at the IHR meeting in December, and he gave the most amazing speech. I think it's online now from the IHR. Is it, Fernando?
Yes, it is.
Is it online?
Thank you, Charles.
And I would recommend everybody listen to it because he is one of the most exciting speakers I have heard in this movement in years. And the discussion afterward was fantastic, too. And my favorite quote of the whole evening was, you know, we were discussing certain positions and how people reacted to it. And, you know, Fernando said, well, people ask me how I feel, and I give them my reaction. They say, they say, well, my God, that means you're a fascist. And he said, you know, I sort of blush and feel quite honored when they say that. This is the man we're talking to, and he is just really one of my new heroes, I have to say. But I wanted to talk about a few things today that I think are terribly relevant, because nationalism and identitarianism has this odd reputation of being a cult of hate, right? I mean, that's how the mainstream media and everybody would like to portray us anyhow. And so I want to start out with just one of the possibly hottest things going on in the United States right now, and it's a wonderful day for it. Did either of you know that today is the 180th anniversary of Texas independence?
I didn't know.
Because at a little town on the Brazos River in Texas, called Washington on the Brazos, on this day, a group of people declared their independence from Mexico. It was during the siege of the Alamo. The Santa Ana had already laid siege to the Alamo. That was going on. William Barrett Travis was holding the fort, and it fell a few days later after a 13-day siege, very famous. But it's interesting because Fernando asked me just before the talk began, what was the composition of Texas before the revolution? Was it all Anglo? Was it mostly Mexican? Was it mixed? And the answer is that it's really very much like it is today. It was very much a mixed Spanish Anglo group. The earliest Anglo settlers who came to Texas actually converted to Catholicism in order to be admitted. Moses Austin and his son Stephen F. Austin, after whom the capital city were named, they were actually born, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, but to come to Texas, they agreed to convert to Catholicism. And so they had come very much with the intention of living according to Mexican customs and laws, but they, got the idea that Mexico itself had deviated from the Constitution of 1824, which is very liberal, you know, French Revolution era type of constitution. And the interesting thing is that one of the authors of the Texas Declaration of Independence, there were really two authors. One was George Childress, who was obviously a WASP, and the other was Ernesto Zavala, who was actually born in the state of Yucatan in far southeastern Mexico. And I think one of the more interesting things about Texas and Mexican history is that Texas, of course, was famous for its republic, and we still talk about the Republic of Texas movement these days, but Yucatan also formed a republic, and for a while in the 1840s, Yucatan and Texas were allies. And, you know, today we've got Donald Trump talking about how he wants to deport a large portion of the Latino population, and ironically enough, he is kind of a social liberal in a lot of ways, and his biggest opponents are Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, who are both Latinos in some sense, at least by their surname. And I wonder, how does that, Fernando, how does that fit into your concept of identitarian politics?
Well, it's interesting that you mention it. You mentioned a few interesting things that I would like to talk about, but the last thing you said about Trump, Ted Cruz, and Rubio relating to identity, they may be Latino, but it relates to what you were saying at the beginning of how people want to portray identitarianism. And one thing is like the social image that we want to give, the tactical and strategic marketing that we might use for people to get closer to us. But the people, like the ideologues of the movement, like us, we need to go a little deeper into the philosophy and the meaning and the understanding of what we are standing for. And identity is a combination of a people, like an ethnia, their land, and their experiences, the things that they experience together, that they live together. So those things combined, that's what makes an identity. If there is a guy called Roger Cortez or Rogelio Cortez who was born in Germany and raised in Germany and has lived all his life in Germany, and he calls me up and he says, you know what, it turns out that we're cousins and we should make an alliance because we have the same identity. Well, we can make an alliance because we have the same ideas, but we don't have the same identity. It's because we don't have the same experiences. I've never, like, 2 weeks is at most what I've been in Germany, and he probably never visited Mexico. So it comes down to a philosophical, Aristotelic understanding of what something is. If you have a piece of glass which you can drink water from, that piece of glass is not a glass of water until you actually pour water on it and drink from it. That's when it gains its identity as a glass of water. And the same is for people. So when people want to say that just because a guy has for example, a Latino last name, well, that cannot be the motor for me to siding with someone or not siding with someone, because I have to understand and analyze where they are coming from, what they stand for, what they have lived. And in that sense, I mean, I'm not, like I told you before the show, I haven't looked into Ted Cruz and Rubio because I don't think they can actually beat Trump in the candidacy run. But well, that would be my answer towards the identitarian side of the identitarian movements relating to people like Ted and Rubio. It's not in the true identitarian spirit to think that Latinos should take over the United States and unite with Mexicans, because they are not really Mexicans, and Mexicans are not really American Hispanic. There's different identities, and we at most can make an alliance.
Okay. There's something I want to interject here, because I want to precisely. He said some very interesting things, and that one of the topics we always come around to discussing is race genetic, or is it a cultural construct? That's something we're always coming around to, it seems like, isn't it? Fernando, would you agree that your definition of identity is primarily that it is a cultural construct rather than a racial or genetic construct?
Well, no. I couldn't completely agree with me thinking that, because I also think that it is a combination. I do believe that if you, for example, mix a race, for example, Mexico. Mexico has a lot of genotypes and phenotypes that have not been stabilized yet. So do I think that in the long run, the collective unconscious, if we have an identitarian movement, a collective unconscious and a common goal for Mexico, will stabilize the genetics of Mexico and spawn what we could call a race? Yes, I do think it would. Do I think that without the race and without the genetic balance and stability, you can have a true national identity? No, I think that would be incomplete, and it would lead to trouble and different identities, like you have, for example, in L.A. You cannot have a common goal for the city of Los Angeles when you have the Ukrainians, the Armenians, the black people, the Italians, and the Russians, and the Mexicans. I mean, they can agree that they want more money. That's pretty much the only thing they can all agree on. But they will never strive for a spiritual, moral, ethical, and especially religious goal. So I think that in the long run, identity has to be linked to the genetic background and genetic balance. Do I think that when people mix their races, they pretty much should be discarded and thrown in the trash because they lost the purity that makes an identity? No. I think we have been mixing for a long time, and that doesn't matter. You can stabilize the genes, but that doesn't mean that we should mix. That's what people get it wrong. They think that it's either everybody, you know, they think that, I think I made my point kind of clear. Was that clear enough?
What you're saying is that you want to, that you feel that the job of Mexican identitarians and Mexican nationalists is to create an identity which currently is imperfect and does not exist.
The question is, how do you define identity in Mexico? There's a lot of different. There might be some people who identify more with Spain. There might be some movements that have a strong sort of indigenous background. They might identify with their indigenous heritage. Then you have sort of the idea of a civic nationalism, which just says, like, what's best for the country, and those distinctions don't matter. What's just your personal ideal for a Mexican identitarian movement?
Well, I think that even though they don't consciously know it, most Mexicans, their different genotypes and the different genotype dominance in different regions of Mexico have influenced the character and how they have seen and experienced the world over time, especially since the independence. So those different regions have developed different identities that do need to be stabilized. But in general, we are already willing to back each other up, and I think it would be a mistake to try and fragment Mexico down, especially from a tactical, geopolitical standpoint. If each state of Mexico was the size of Mexico, then maybe I would think that it would be better to make four or five republics and respect different identities that don't really have that much to do with each other. But given the current realistic state of Mexico, I think that we must make an effort to create that national identity, even though the current unconscious, unspoken caste system in which ethnically people kind of stay separate, that's probably going to continue. And it would probably take hundreds of years to actually see ethnically which genotype would dominate. But I don't think it is worth it for Mexico to start a caste war, because it isn't part of its essence. It's happened before, but the only people who could actually do that would be the criollos, which are a very small minority, and the actual ethnic Indians, which are also a very small minority and pretty much don't want anything to do with anybody anyway. So I think that it is everybody in the middle, everyone in the middle, which includes millions of white people, millions of lightly brown people, and millions of brown people. Those are the ones that should start striving to create an identity. These are the cards that have been dealt to us, and we have to just face destiny for whatever it brings us. And I think that the opportunity to unite them today is this anger and this animosity towards the government. If there is one thing that can unite the collective, that is uniting the collective unconscious right now of Mexico, is that everybody knows there's something very, very wrong in the government and in the people that control the politics of the country. Everybody is really just wanting to pop and do something about it, but we can't, because our government is pampered and protected by the government of the United States. And that is why the alliance between, I think, identitarians of the United States and identitarians of Mexico is so important. Because on one side, we need Americans to, and especially the American government, to stop protecting and denounce and condemn the corrupt government of Mexico so that Mexicans can take a stand against it. For example, in the Identitarian Congress, there were colonels there There were generals there, retired generals, a lot of people representing military groups, but they're not going to go against people, you know, that they know are backed by the Marines and the Navy and the UN and all of that. So from one side, we need the United States to back off from protecting the Mexican government so we can retake our country and make it a sovereign nation. And on the other side, you have 40 million Mexicans, Hispanics, and I don't know if 40 million is just Mexicans or all the Latinos, but let's say you have only 20 million Mexicans in the United States, I don't know the exact number, that you could be using in your favor for marches, for votes, for protection of white identity, people that could be your allies, and that in the long run will simply out to self-deport themselves. Because, you know, all Mexicans in the United States, they have something they miss in Mexico. They miss their land. They miss their mothers or their grandmothers, their brothers. It's not like we hate Mexico. They simply don't have an opportunity over there to make a better life. So if we could make the conditions in Mexico to be a normal country, then they would go back. And that's where I think the alliance can work both ways.
Could we ask him how would Robert suggest that we reach out to the Mexicans to make them part of our movement? I mean, how would we begin that process?
I think change is going to have to happen through Mexico itself, and then possibly once changes happen in Mexico, that could have an influence. The problem with the United States is you have people here, and they've been used as pawns by the American political elite, so those people might be more difficult to form some kind of a political alliance with. Changes can have to come through Mexico.
Yes, well, I think that if I understood you correctly, you were talking about the synergy that there is between the Mexican government and the people of the United States that profit from the migration and all the charities and let's help the third world open border movements. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, exactly.
Yes, well, that's where I'm coming from, and I'll answer both questions at the same time. Those people in Mexico are not the people that actually represent the Mexican sentiment. It's not like Mexicans, you know, have as a goal to go to the United States and be helped by the liberals and stuff. The most poor Mexicans, that's why many of them are criminals and stuff, because they didn't have an education. Most of those poor Mexicans that end up migrating, they just do it because it's their only chance, it's their only hope. So when they get there and they tell them, I'm going to put a T-shirt on you that says, feel the burn. And this is what you're going to say when you get to the United States, that you're tired of the Americans taking advantage of you, and you come here to reclaim your rights. So they say, okay, I'll say that. As long as you give me a job and a house, I'll say whatever you want. You know, that they're indoctrinated. And at the same time, the people that support all those movements, the neocons that use the labor force, of illegal immigrants, and the liberals who profit from the quote-unquote misery of Mexicans, they are not representing white America either. So that's why the alliance, I think, should be between Mexican nationalists and white America, like white identitarians, because that's where the roads don't collide. They're kind of parallel, and we're kind of looking for the same things. So when Charles asked me how we could do that, I think there's two channels. For example, one could be through people like me in the United States when the time comes, that actually start talking to people and give them a real dose of what history is and what happened. And the second way, for the narrative of white America to include the denouncement of the Mexican corrupt government protected by masonry and by the United States government, which promotes migration. The white America to understand that it's the Mexican government and the United States government promoting the migration. And the people that migrate, the illegal aliens, they are only the bullets. They are not the gun, and they are not the people triggering the gun. They are just the pawns. So whenever somebody says, oh, instead of telling a guy, hey, go back to your country, because you know he's not going to anyways. You can tell him, you know what, I wish that we could do something to bring that corrupt government down that made you come here so you could go back to your home and live where you actually want to live instead of us having to help you. It's not fair that the Mexican government made you come here. And that's when people can say, okay, well, that's right. My real enemy is the Mexican government. The Mexican government is the one that made me go through hell getting to TJ or to the Arizona desert and almost dying and dehydrating just to go to another country to see what I can make of my life. Why couldn't I make my life in Mexico? Why? Because the Mexican government is stealing everything it can and it profits from poverty.
And it serves as a safety valve, because if people aren't happy, they can just leave. But if they didn't have that option of leaving, that then basically that anger would build up that could lead to a revolution.
Exactly. That's exactly the reason why I wouldn't care if Trump built a wall, you know, because that would take off the pressure valve. Well, in the meantime, because the cartels would end up making high-tech tunnels and profit from getting people in through tunnels. But at the beginning, at least, it would reduce it. It would reduce the migration, and it would remove that safety valve, and it would put a lot of pressure on the Mexican government.
And then you have the issue of trade, and same with what Trump is talking about, is bringing back manufacturing jobs. And I think what happened with that, if we were to end outsourcing and globalization, I think in the short term it could have some negative impacts on Mexico's economy, because if you bring back those jobs, then those workers would become unemployed. But in the long term, what would happen is it would force Mexico to sort of relocalize its economy. So you would have a return to localized economies, people owning their own farms, instead of having these multinational corporations owning all the agriculture. I think I also heard Citibank owns most of the banks in Mexico as well.
That's exactly right. I was laughing the other day because I was listening to a Trump statement on YouTube that some Mexicans were kind of complaining about because they don't know what they're talking about. And it was Trump saying, and I'm not saying that I endorse Trump completely or that I trust him. You know, there's many reserves I have about Trump, but just about his narrative, what he was saying that he was going to get all the American companies back to the United States to make factories in the United States, and he was going to get them out of everywhere, including Mexico, and he was going to tax them 30% if they stayed outside of the United States. And I was laughing because, you know, almost since like 12, 13 years ago, in those movements we were talking about that we founded before, we were talking about that before, we would make plans, like national plans. That's kind of like the project you make for when you get to power, just as essays and as exercises to exactly know and say what we would do in the country if we ever got to power. And one of the first things that we would do in about the second year of the six-year term was going to be to tax the international companies 25% if they wanted to stay in Mexico, just so we would force them out. And like you're saying, at the beginning, that would bring up a lot of shortage on many things and a little bit of labor chaos. But at the same time, we could look for, like it was done in the 30s and the 40s, well, mainly the 30s in Europe, we could find a way to finance using national materia prima, I guess you say, like national resources to start making those same, like the companies we need and the technology we need and providing people of everything they need, but with national production. So we don't have to, for example, so we don't have to make jeans, and then we make a jean in Mexico, we make a pair of pants or something, and it costs us, let's say, $1,
and then we send it back to the United States, and then a designer or whatever puts their name on it, and then they send it back to Mexico, and they sell it for $9, and that's what people have to pay. And those are the kind of ridiculous things. And I'm just talking about clothing, but we do the same with gasoline. We need to extract the oil, then we need to send it to American refineries, and then it gets sent back to Mexico as gasoline, and we have to pay the international prices. Those are the things that don't actually make sense. We were talking about Texas which is an interesting topic if you compare the Texas now of the Texas then. But the Texas now just gave an award to the Mexican president like 2 weeks ago, like a little trophy, because of his new politics that now everybody is going to be able to sell their gasoline in Mexico, like Chevron and everything, and all of them are going to be able, through the NAFTA and the new TPP and all that, they're going to be able to go directly to Mexico and sell their gasoline. But at the same time, the Mexican government refuses to make refineries that will produce gasoline in Mexico. So that's when you know it's actually just a puppet. It's your enemy that's in power. It's the enemy of the people of in Mexico that is in power, and we need to do something about it. But that enemy has a bodyguard called the United States, and that's where it all kind of gets a little bit complicated.
If you look at politics in Latin America, it seems to be either the trend is you either get plutocracy where the rich control everything, or the other alternative you get is you get socialism. Do you think there can be sort of a third way to socialism and plutocratic capitalism?
I kind of understood the question of either I think capitalism or socialism can do something good for Mexico, or should we look for a third position or a position in the middle to help? But are you talking about Mexico or the United States?
I'm talking about Mexico, but this relates to, like, all countries.
Okay, well, I am a firm believer that the history has shaped and reshaped nations a lot, and demographics and identities, and I do think that both of those very old and destructive models that we keep clinging on to because of fear of making a mistake, like capitalism and socialism, I think that we should look into a third way or a third position, rescuing the best things of socialism, rescuing the best things of nationalism, and rescuing the good parts of things like capitalism and international competition to make a new model that can push nations into the future that humanity deserves, all identities, into a planet where each identity and nation is growing academically and technologically, and kind of aspiring to explore the world around it, even space, instead of thinking how much I'm going to sell a Twinkie or a piece of bread to the nation beside me just to make an extra profit, regardless of the poverty or the problems and the wars that can arise because of it. I think that the IQ and the ambition of humanity, because of liberalism and the savage capitalism, is reducing itself. The IQ is reducing itself, and we're going step by step into a stage where we're becoming more of a inferior and primitive species on the planet that's going to self-destruct itself instead of reaching the potential that we had.
Do you see a lot of influence of kind of American consumer culture on Mexico, stuff like political correctness, but also the culture of, say, stuff like Walmart and McDonald's?
Yes, that is something that some people don't know. That in Mexico, you know, it's supposed to be very cheap and very poor, but now we are seeing the same patterns and the same products in the same stores and almost the same prices that you see in the United States. And we're already competing with the United States in obesity, and we're already competing with the United States in pesticide-related health problems, in hormone disruptions, in gender loss or gender neutralness or whatever you want to call it, that it's actually just medical conditions that come from food that we shouldn't be eating. And that's pretty much what we're importing from the United States instead of the good things. And the good things in the United States are being suppressed more and more and being left to be abandoned in the middle-class white America that's being pressed down on very hard right now. So I do think that there's a lot of influence, bad influence, going from Mexico to the United States and from the United States to Mexico. Neighboring countries will always have an influence on each other. There's never going to be a time where Mexicans and Americans don't look at each other and are not neighbors. But we should be importing and sharing what's good and best about our cultures. And the people going back and forth should be our best people, our best engineers, our best athletes, our best diplomats to make a good relationship. Instead of sending the poor, uneducated, many times criminals of Mexico into the United States, and instead of getting many Americans and stuff that are just, orchestrating scams and organ harvesting and child pornography in Mexico with the protection of corrupt Mexican politicians. So we're basically being controlled by a force that just wants to see both societies in decline. And I'm not talking about a outer space conspiracy that people sit down on a round table and make these terrible decisions. I'm just talking about the greed, that the model that we have today is making sociopaths be more fit to go into power and be more fit to be CEOs and be more fit to take general decisions. So when you sum those decisions up, the result that you get is a decline in the moral, cultural, and spiritual quality of nations.
I kind of wanted to, go back just for a second, though, to what he was saying about Chevron and the oil companies from the U.S. going into Mexico. And does that mean that the... Can you just explain a little bit more about what you were saying about that? What are the consequences of that? I mean, Mexico had a national oil monopoly for like 76 years in Petróleos Mexicanos, and I guess they've decided to dismember that then?
Yes. I'll try to break it down, giving the example of the banks, being that I was closely related to that example, since one of the last things that my family owned in the 80s, that it was part of the heritage that they created since they got to Mexico from Spain, were banks. And they were really into the banking system, national banking system of Mexico. And it was a lot of a healthier and more social banking system. And it came to a point when the communist or socialist or liberal, whatever you want to call it, it's actually just a plot, policies came into place with a new left-wing USSR-friendly president that they wanted to nationalize everything. One of the things they nationalized first was the oil, and they created that monopoly you were talking about, which later became just a safe from where all those corrupt families and pretty much just scum of Mexico started stealing the money from, because there was so much money being made from oil that nobody of the Mexican mass could understand the amount of money that was being extracted from the arcs of the oil reserves in Mexico. And then that's why they kept the oil monopoly for so long. But then they did the same to the banks, and in the 80s they illegally took the banks from my family and everything that the banks owned, saying that it was just to make it national so that people would, so that monopolies and families, rich families, wouldn't control Mexican economy. Then what they did next was mismanage the banks, steal the money from the banks, pocket it into their own accounts, and break the banks, make them broke. So then what they did after that was auction the banks. But when Mexicans tried to buy the banks, they said that the only condition of the auction was that only international institutions that already owned other banks were able to participate in the auction. So that's when HSBC and Goldman Sachs and all the international banking cartels
bought the banks of Mexico from the government after the government took them from the people. So it's the same thing with the oil. First they nationalized oil, then they stole all the money they could. They closed down the refineries. They made all those 200, 300 families that used to be poor before the revolution and just thieves and savages. They took all that money and became the quote-unquote political class, political high class of Mexico. And now that the Pemex is broke and that it has no future and no refineries, they pushed this reform, constitutional reform, to let foreign investment and private investment participate in Pemex and be part owner of the oil extraction and be able to sell their oil products to the Mexican people without restrictions. And now they just added this new, let's say, annex to the reform, which says that gasoline that was not made in Mexico, but it's owned by companies that are investing in Mexico and part owners of oil extraction in Mexico, can come to Mexico and sell their gasoline directly to the people at international prices. But this also includes the fact that no refineries will be made in Mexico, so there will be no Mexican gasoline to compete with them on, except for the gasoline that is already part owned by those same companies. I don't know if I made myself clear of the circle they're making.
Let me just see if I can summarize what you just said. In both banking and in oil, the Mexican pattern has been first nationalize, then bankrupt, and then sell to foreign entities, which is in effect depriving Mexico of every bit of economic or political autonomy it could ever have.
Exactly. And it's happening too with the oil, with silver and gold extraction through NAFTA.
And this is very much like what's happening to the United States in terms of the Trans-Pacific deal that they're cutting. We are alienating our own national resources and our own industries, whatever's left of them, to foreign countries. And so basically everything is going to be globally controlled. There will be no national economies left at all. Do you think that's basically where it's going?
I think that's what they're trying to do. But recently, I think in the last decade, everything is kind of, to my eyes, falling out of control for them economically and bellically or militarily and socially. And things just have gotten so ridiculous with the cultural Marxism and political correctness and the fact that this so-called savage capitalism cannot sustain a middle class that is big enough to maintain the majority of votes to promote it and protect it, that more and more people around the world, in the United States and in Mexico, are getting angry at that fact and are trying to start to look for different alternatives. That's why I think that the phenomenon, like the one happening with Donald Trump, can be seen in different parts of the world. Well, the only reason I'm not getting my hopes up is because I've already have these hopes before with President Fox in Mexico and with Haider in Austria and with different personalities around the world, that you think they're going to do something when they get to power, and then you see that it was all just part of the plan that they had. And I must say that I'm a little bit afraid that Donald Trump may win, and then he's just going to intentionally collapse the American finance while he's deporting people. So then the media, the liberal media, can blame the economic collapse that is already dawning on quote-unquote white America and quote-unquote racist America, just to suppress the momentum that white Americans have been gaining for these last 10 years and delay their opportunity to rise to power for another 50 years. That's the only thing that would worry me. But, if you compare it to what Bernie Sanders would do, which would be disarm people, and when you compare it to what Hillary Clinton would do, which would be attack Iran and probably start a war with Russia, well, then he does seem like the best option. And some of the people in our movement have been endorsing him. I really hope that they have done the research, and I trust in them that he might be the best option. But answering your question again, I think that's what they want to do, but I think that it's really going to collapse before they can actually do it. And it's going to come down to us, how much we're going to let the system and society collapse before we put a stop to them.
Let's say that America does sort of head in a more like nationalist, populist or identitarian direction. Do you think that would inevitably lead to conflict between Americans and Mexicans, not so much in Mexico, but within the United States?
No. I think that if it is wrongly focused, it can. Just like there can be a conflict between you and me or you and Charles. If you misinterpret the words of someone else and the goals of someone else, and there's not an intelligent and higher education communication, that can happen. If you put the typical American, white American, that simply lost his job and is suffering from the economical crisis, and he doesn't exactly know why, and he doesn't know about this international phenomena, and he doesn't know why Mexicans migrate, if you put him in a ring, and then you put a Mexican in the ring, which has always been told that he was an Indian, and that he was oppressed, and that he was ransacked, and that the United States used to be part of Mexico, and that white people hate him, and that white people see him as inferior. If you put those two people in a room, of course there's going to be a conflict. But what we have to understand and what we have to take action about is that those two people are being played. They are being brainwashed so they don't really attack the source of their problems, which happens to be the same one. So if an identitarian movement would rise up in America, I think that we don't have an anti-white nature or essence in Mexico. We don't have a problem with white communities and strictly white areas or zones. I would never have a problem with that. I actually support the fact that white people must secure their heritage and a future for white children. They need to do that. The world needs that because they are an essential part of the world and of the ethnias of the world, and they have contributed a lot to society and to the whole planet. So there's really no policy in us, identitarians or not, except for the leftists and communists in Mexico, like all over the world, to do anything against white people. There are millions of white people in Mexico, and millions of not just the typical white Hispanic kind of white guy, but actually blonde and blue-eyed people in Mexico who have been there for generations, and you never see on the news anybody being attacked for being white. You never see anything on the news about hate crimes of white Mexicans against brown Mexicans or vice versa, because we weren't indoctrinated with that stuff that they used to indoctrinate in the United States. And, for example, I believe Charles lived for a while in Mexico. Maybe he can also have a say on that, that people in Mexico don't really have a problem with white people.
Mexicans were maybe like third generation, but never from immigrants, really. Usually, like, people have been in this country a couple of generations.
Yes, exactly. That they have been indoctrinated with the American anti-race and all that stuff.
Like, a good example would be the comedian George Lopez.
Oh, ooh. Yeah. Don't even get me started on that.
I don't know who you're talking about. Who's this?
It's a comedian that basically shames white people and their shows and tries to portray them as enemies, as the enemy of Mexicans. But at the same time, he doesn't even speak proper English. He doesn't even speak proper Spanish. And, I mean, who is he? Who does he think he represents? But anyways, I think it's
enough.
Well,
like him, he has no connection to either country because he has no connection to traditional Mexican culture. He has no connection to the traditions of America either. So in a sense, he basically doesn't have any connection to anything.
He's basically a product of American pop culture and public education indoctrination. He's just a spawn
exactly.
of that. So how was your experience in Mexico, Charles? Never asked you that.
Well,
We need an hour to talk about that alone, because I mean, my years in Mexico were some of the happiest years of my life, and I absolutely love your country, and all of the worst things that I've seen happening in Mexico have directly to do with accepting foreign influence, frankly, and so I mean, this is a topic that's very near and dear to my heart, and it's kind of why I wanted to start out with talking about the Texas Independence Day and the traditional notion of animosity, and maybe it's not traditional, maybe it's totally modern, because the original Republic of Texas was very much a bilingual country. There were court cases in both English and Spanish. The founders included Mexican Creole whites, as well as Anglo-Saxon immigrants. And of course, my family in part comes from Louisiana, where we lived under basically the Spanish caste system, and the strongest relics of the Spanish caste system are in Mexico and are in Louisiana and Texas, in the United States anyhow. And so I know that part of the history. And in Mexico, no, I don't think anybody except, you know, leftist students at UNAM and places like that really is anti-American. The anti-Americanism that Robert was referring to in Mexican populations in the U.S., I mean, that's one of the touchiest issues anywhere, because you seem to be saying that they are a potential source of allies for us, but right now they are one of the most fertile grounds for the opposite, and I wonder how we would move over from one to another. I mean, in Santa Ana,
you look at candidates that are running for president. Trump, look at Trump and Bernie Sanders. I don't really want to get into them as individuals per se, but what they symbolize is dissent, and most of their support is predominantly white. I've noticed that Mexican Americans as a group disproportionately support Hillary Clinton.
Yes, I've been talking to Mexican Americans about that since I've been here in California, trying to dig deeper into that. And I've been getting almost the same response, apart from made-up responses that don't make sense. People who actually think about it just tell me, well, that's how it is. You get here to the United States and you vote Democrat, because all the stuff that is going to favor you, you know, getting your residence and getting access to a driver's license and all that stuff, not that you politically agree with it, but that you practically would make life easier for you, like things that favor you, are always things that the Democrats pass. So you don't see who the Democrat is. You don't see their end game. You don't see their foreign international policies. You only see that you need a driver's license so they don't take your car away when you get pulled over. So you vote Democrat, and that's it. So there's never been an identitarian or nationalist movement in the United States that actually tells the Mexican people, even if the end game is for Mexicans to leave, they can make a model in which it can be like systematic and peaceful, and it includes a Mexico that they can actually go back to. That's where it is, because many people, they're not going to go back to Mexico to die of hunger. Of course, they're going to rather die in another country, not specifically the United States, in any other country where they can fight for what they need to have to provide for their family. So that's where I think that they're just being played as pawns. And that's where I think that if the narrative changes a little bit when it comes to nationalist America, and it takes into account the millions of white Mexicans that are already here, and into account all the millions of white Americans that are already mixed with Mexicans, and gives them a place just as far as they can support the fact that America is a white country and there's going to be
strictly white communities and strictly white states and stuff like that, when they understand that that doesn't necessarily mean there's an aggression being made or said, that it's not a micro, quote-unquote, microaggression like the liberals call it, that's when they'll be able to talk to each other on a different level. And I think that this intent and this motor to put Mexican Americans against white Americans has been failing all this time. You know, you don't see that much. You don't see that hate. You don't see those hate crimes and that violence and that anger like you see on many blacks against whites. It's been failing because it's really not in us. Like most Mexican immigrants, they have white friends here. They had white friends in Mexico. They have white relatives. It's never going to be in them to be against white people because we've been with white people for over 300 years in a peaceful and productive relation. So that's why I think that more sinister things are being done right now and that we should take care of and also make this kind of alliances important. One of the things I'm talking about is that it has been recently discovered and started to be documented, although it's not really gone into in depth for now, is that for many years now, about 5-6 years to what they know of, quote-unquote, Europeans have been going into Chiapas. I don't think they're actually Europeans, but they come from Europe. They're going to that Chiapas jungle, and they are indoctrinating Chiapas Indians, Mexican Indians, into radical Islam. So you now have radical Islam cells in the jungle of Mexico. Who and why is funding this? Where are they getting the money? Where did they get the purpose? How are they surviving inside the jungle with those Indians? Because they're very harsh conditions. And what are we going to have in 10 years? Suicide bombings and people yelling Allahu Akbar in Mexican cities coming from the own Mexican jungle. So I think that our opponents have a very long plan, and they are thinking way ahead of us. And we need to stop arguing about the details about what's going to happen in Compton and stuff. Start getting into the real battle, which is the whole planet and the future for our genetics.
You see the American elites as wanting to create a society similar to a lot of these other countries where you have basically, you have a plutocracy that controls all the wealth and a large underclass, slave class, and basically a diminished middle class.
Well, like I was saying before, I see like right now I see like a chaotic difference of opinions and ideas that people have. And I think that the world right now, it used to be controlled by some, and some people have a lot of influence in it, but there's like 10 hands on the wheel of the bus, everybody pulling to a side and everybody part of the elite. And we don't actually know where this bus is going to crash into. I was talking to a neocon about this the other day because I wanted to see their perspective, and it was a little bit interesting. I don't know enough of American history to give him a reply. Like, he just left me speechless at that moment because the only thing that I could think about to rebuke what he was saying were spiritual arguments. And since we weren't talking about that, okay, so what this guy was telling me, this is what the neocon, American white neocon, told me. Maybe you guys can give me some input on this. He told me, I told him about what we were talking about, and he said that the United States started as a meritocracy environment, and since that time, American families were striving and fighting to create fortunes and create a heritage for their own, and that lasted for a long time up to the 50s after the post-war economical boom, and that those white areas and those white communities that I was talking about do exist, but they're not talked about, and you have to afford to live in them. You have to be very rich to live in them, and that the white people that didn't make the cut to live there and to be part of those societies are intentionally being left behind because they're simply, well, kind of paraphrasing, like, not white anymore. Like, they don't... Like he said, it's not worth of them saving them from the melting pot because we already had many generations of white Americans fighting to see who was going to be on top, and the ones who made it on top, like him, are the only ones worthy of staying there. What would you guys think about that?
Robert, do you think that's true, what Fernando just said about America? I don't think so, do you? Fernando just said that he thought, you think that there is still a white elite that's just hiding away somewhere?
Well, the point he was making is, I can say California, if you want to live in a white neighborhood, you need to basically be able to afford like $1 million home.
I mean, even those white neighborhoods, so-called, are mostly now integrated. I mean, I went back to, last year I went back to my hometown of Dallas, and Dallas used to be, a major white city, all white city, and it's not anymore. And Harvard, where I went to school, used to be like the center of the WASP elite, and Harvard has now had two Jewish presidents, and Donald Trump, who is like a newcomer in the white elite group. He's not old money, really. He's sort of what you'd call nouveau riche. He's got an integrated family also. And I was just listening to what Fernando was saying. He was saying that he thought that there was, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Fernando, but what I understood you to be saying was that you think that there is still an American WASP elite that's in power somewhere.
It's not exactly what I think. It's not what I think. And I was talking to this guy who was a conservative, like a Republican, and that believes in capitalism and believes that America is on the right track and has money, and he thinks that everything's okay. And I was talking to him about what we're talking about, and that's what he answered me. So that's when I didn't really know enough about the demographics and the history of American society to give him a response that I thought could make a fracture in his argument. I did tell him two things. I told him about what you're saying, that all of those communities all do have people that are not white and of different identities and stuff, and he simply said that he's going to need somebody to remodel his house and clean his pool and clean his toilet and cook his food, and he doesn't want them living too far away because he wants them there on time. That's what he said first. Then I talked to him about the Jewish integration, and he said, well, Jews were always like kind of latched on to Europeans, so when this race started, it's a race not as ethnically, but as a sprint to run to see who got on top. The Jews participated, and white Jews made it too. So they're going to stay there. That's what he said. So I don't know how many white Americans that are actually on the top of the middle class and in the high class actually think like this. And that could be one of the reasons that they never support white identitarian movements, because they don't believe that they need to. Although, if you ask my personal opinions, the spiritual and the moral and the productive and the IQ quality of these people, no matter how rich they are, is decaying. So the only thing that's going to happen is that in 100 years, of those 1,000 families, 100 of them are still going to be rich, living in China, and the other ones are going to be just as poor as the new Super Mexico that's going to go from Yucatan to Canada, when there's just going to be a third world block. And it's really not working out. I don't think that this capitalist, individualistic, everyone for himself movement or current or ideology is going to take humanity to anywhere good.
We're getting towards the end. We have about 5 minutes left. Fernando, do you have some points that we didn't get a chance to touch upon that you want to get across to our audience?
Well, something that a very quick thing. We've gone into many topics, but something that I didn't say is that I think the Texas independence point, it's not that I don't have any sentiment as a Mexican about it, but I think that most Mexicans and Hispanics don't actually go into how Texas was at that time, how difficult it was to get to Texas, and how alienated the Texans were from the rest of Mexico, and how unstable Mexico was at the moment because of Napoleon invading Spain and the Mexican independence. So I really don't have a fit with Texans, because I know that it came to a point where they knew that there was going to be
a fight, and they had to choose who they were going to side with, and they sided with the people that were closest to them, because you don't want to side with the people that are far away and having an enemy right next to you. They were going to get smashed by the Americans if they sided with Mexico and started a war against the United States. They were going to be the frontliners of the war, and that's why I think that many of those factors, people don't take them into account when they talk about the Texas independence and they see Texans as traitors to Mexico.
Well, I would just like to say I hope we can revisit these topics again in a second. I think Fernando merits at least a second session here, and I think that these are just Fernando basically is speaking in a creative way that very few people in the American movement are able to do, and I think that his perspective is just one of the most valuable things have come across in a very long time, and I really hope that we'll be able to continue these discussions and expand them, because he's got a future orientation that I think is lacking in the white nationalist community generally, about process, about social process, and the reality of politics at the present time, and we need him speaking all over the country to our groups and our people, because we need this expanded perspective of what it means to create new nations and what it means to create strong ethnic identities. And I am very pleased to have had the opportunity to meet Fernando and
thank you, Charles.
Bring
I'm
him
flattered
onto the
with
show.
What you're saying.
Fernando, it's
so
really been a great show. I'd like to thank you for being on. We've covered so many really fundamentally crucial topics.
Well, let's do it again soon. And
yes, thank you very
Texas,
much for
Texas.
Having me, Robert. It was a great show. I just didn't answer because I was thinking maybe one day in your show you can take calls or something, because sometimes I would like to listen to questions and points of view of white Americans that don't agree with me, so that I can get a better perspective of the sentiment of the collective unconscious of white Americans. Because I know there are people out there, every time I give an interview or something, that don't agree with what I'm saying and don't like what I'm saying. But if they don't confront me, it's difficult for me to take into account their opinion and make a broader perspective on the situation in the United States.
So, Fernando, thanks again for being on. That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll talk with you next time.
Thank you
very
much,
Robert.
Happy
Independence Day, everybody. You talk here. Bye-bye.
Good day. Bye.
Take care, Robert.